powie pan?
Tak, mi się wydaje.
Drodzy Państwo, witam serdecznie, witamy serdecznie. Zakład Kultury Miejskiej chciałbym zaprosić na dzisiaj na specjalny wykład naszego gościa, pana doktora Keneta Wanteja, który przedstawi wykład na temat Bhagavata Purany, prawda? Bhagavata Purana jako rozszerzenie Vedanty. Let me introduce our special guest, Professor Kenneth Wanteja from the Oxford University, from the Oxford Center for Hindu Studies, who is going to give us a lecture on the Bhagavata Purana as extension of Vedanta.
Okay.
Dr. Wanteja.
Thank you very much, Dr. Stewart. And thank you all for coming. I hope that my English will not be a problem. I will try to speak slowly and clearly. I would ask you to interrupt me if there is something unclear. Please do feel free to say, stop, slow down, back up. What is it going on here? Okay, I'm going to try to give a sketch of a few ideas. This may not be very systematic, because as most scholarly work tends to be, this is work in progress, and it helps me to clear my ideas by speaking with you. Let me start by... No? More coming? I'm going to look down. There's still another row here in front as well. This is row 3, not reserved. As I was saying, I'll be speaking in English, hopefully not too quickly. First, I should perhaps say something about the Puranic genre. Many of you may not be familiar with this particular genre of Sanskrit literature. It's usually identified in terms of great Puranas and minor Puranas. Great Puranas are usually listed as being 18 in number. And the dating of the Puranas, as with practically all early Indian classical literature, is very difficult. The tradition of the Bhagavata Purana is that it was spoken, it was compiled at the time of the departure, or soon after the departure of Krishna from the world, which means the end of the Dvapara Yuga, the vast age, which ended, according to the tradition, some 5,000 years ago or more. That's the Puranic version. The scientist version, the historical critical version, is that the Bhagavata Purana in particular is possibly as late in its present form as 1000, the year 1000 of the, or the century, 10th century, let's say, of the Common Era. And that is open to debate. There are some who will argue, no, it is 9th, 8th century, and there are some who will go as far back as the Gupta period, 5th century, to that effect. But I won't be so concerned with the dating of the Puranas. I'm more concerned with the content, and I think that sort of lines up with philological concern in general. This is the philological faculty. The Puranic genre in general would not generally be thought of as commentary to philosophical literature, and that's why the Bhagavata Purana, many things about it are interesting, but this is one of the interesting things about it, that the Bhagavata Purana, unlike others which are very much preoccupied with what might be called popular religion, with the activities that one might practice as a devotee of one or another divinity or god. The Bhagavata Purana is also concerned with that, but it is also very concerned with philosophy. It seems to be, well, you might say a preoccupation of the Bhagavata Purana. What sort of length is this work? The tradition tells us that the Bhagavata Purana is 18,000 verses in length. Some have counted the present editions of the Bhagavata Purana and come up with something over 14,000 verses in 12 skandhas or books, cantos, of which the 10th is certainly the most famous as well as the longest. It's also the most popular, and I should maybe mention that there is one press in India called Gita Press, which publishes very inexpensive versions of Bhagavad Gita, Mahabharata, Ramayana, and also Bhagavata Purana, and Ramcharitamanas. These are the main texts that they print. And the Mahabharata, the Ramcharitamanas, they print in the millions. The Bhagavata Purana, they print in the hundreds of thousands. Something like 400,000 was the last number that I read on their latest edition. 400,000 is quite a good number, I think. So it is also a popular work, although it is in Sanskrit, and it is so philosophical. All right. Now, there's been a study on the Bhagavata Purana called the Advaitic Theism of the Bhagavata Purana by one Daniel Sheridan, who teaches in Maine, in northeastern United States. And as the title suggests, he argues that the Bhagavata Purana is presenting a particular slant on Vedanta, which he calls Advaitic Theism. Without a doubt, the Bhagavata Purana is strongly theistic, and this, you might say, is what sets it apart, in a sense, as what I'm calling a commentary to Vedanta. But I think that Advaitic Theism doesn't quite tell the whole story. It helps, certainly, to kind of get one oriented what the Bhagavata is about, but I would suggest it goes really very far beyond that in interesting ways. To say something about about Vedanta, for those of you not, how many of you are familiar with the term Vedanta? Okay, several. Some are sort of halfway putting up your hands. Okay. So some familiarity is there. As you, those of you who know, will understand, the term Vedanta is usually associated with the Upanishads, that genre of ancient Sanskrit literature, which is very much interested in philosophical speculation. One scholar at the University of Vancouver, Ashok Akhlujkar, gave a very nice paper in Oxford couple of years ago, in which he showed how he traced back very carefully the word Vedanta to see how it has the history of the term and the history of the concept of Vedanta. And he has shown that what we usually think of as Vedanta now, as a kind of very specific, well, yes, as one branch of one type of six darshanas, classical types of philosophy in India, is really a later development. And that one can speak of, in earlier times, one can speak of Sankhya Vedanta, Yoga Vedanta, and the other sort of types or trends of philosophy in India as being Vedanta, where we might say the term Vedanta means end of Veda, somehow a conclusion to Veda. This conclusion is not necessarily the specialized discipline that we understand now as Vedanta or Uttara Mimamsa. Okay. Before I move on to more substance of how the Bhagavata is a commentary on Vedanta, one more word about the nature of the Bhagavata Purana. One can naturally ask for whom was the Bhagavata Purana written, in what circumstance? Generally, it can be understood. There was a group of people called the Bhagavatas. They saw themselves as Bhagavatas, as opposed to perhaps Shaivites, possibly even as opposed to, in some way differentiated from, Vaishnavites. Bhagavatas were a kind of apparently inclusivist group who wanted to legitimize their position, their philosophical position, and of course their practice. Probably this was connected also with some construction of temples. Temple worship is happening at this time. Temples are coming up. Kings are sponsoring temples. So the question is, whom do we worship in the temple and why? Why worship Vishnu or Narayana or Shiva and so on? So the texts are there to anchor, to philosophically anchor what is probably already happening in the temples, but somehow needs to be justified, legitimated. Okay, so the question is now how, I'm claiming that the Bhagavata is a kind of commentary on Vedanta, and I mean that in both senses, the narrow and the broad sense. Commentary is, you could say, in any case, what is happening in the Sanskrit tradition of India. One text is commenting on the one before, which is commenting on the one before, which is commenting on the one before. Everybody is putting in, as we say in English, their two cents, or maybe five zlotys. to say, well, they got it right previously, but we don't really understand how they got it right. So I'm going to tell you now how they got it right, and by the way, I'll show you how our tradition has a kind of better understanding than was there previously. So scholars say about the Puranas that on the one hand they are claiming to be history, Purana, ancient literature, ancient lore, if you like, Purana meaning ancient, but simultaneously they're offering something new, something that wasn't there before. So the Bhagavata Purana is doing very much the same. Looking at themes of Vedanta in general, we might just recognize basic themes of philosophy. One, epistemology, then ontology, than, at least in the case of Vedanta, cosmology, and something you won't find in Western philosophy, soteriology. Soteriology, is that a familiar term?
Yes.
Okay. I don't want to leave you behind. So the Bhagavata is certainly interested in all of these themes. It is not the case, one has to say, that the Bhagavata is going kind of step by step through, let's say, the Brahma Sutras, which are the Nyaya Prasthana, the sort of foundational text for the Vedanta, the later Vedantic tradition of understanding what is the meaning of the Upanishads. It is not systematic in that way. Some scholars have made attempts to link this Vedanta Sutra with that verse from the Bhagavata Purana. I don't know how successfully, but I can say that the very first verse of the Bhagavata Purana stands out as practically an obvious commentary to Vedanta Sutra, in particular Vedanta Sutra 1.1.2. But I'm getting slightly ahead of myself. I want to just mention, for those of you not familiar, that the Brahma Sutras, sometimes called Vedanta Sutras, are a collection, another type of genre, of text sutra literature. And sutra means string. And it refers to strings of aphorisms, probably used originally as mnemonic devices, ways of helping to remember a philosophical system. Vedanta Sutra has some 550 such very short, pithy statements, which if you or I try to read them by themselves will make absolutely no sense whatsoever. They beg for a commentary, and they have received commentary from many, the most famous being the commentary of Shankara, or Shankaracharya. Four sections of the Vedanta Sutra. The first one is called Samanvaya, or reconciliation. It's about showing how the statements of the Upanishads are connected. They all make a single point or a series of points which are cohesive. So the beginning of the Vedanta Sutra is telling us that. After that comes the second, I won't go into details, but the second and third, second section has to do with showing how it is not opposed. It's taking different philosophies and shooting them down. It's taking Buddhism, for example, at least represent in its own kind of representation. It does kind of philosophical, what I call philosophical skeet shooting. You may not know that word, but for rifle practice, they will shoot up a target, a flying target in the air, and then you shoot it. So the second part is taking one philosophy after another and shooting it down, starting with different forms of Buddhism and going through various other systems to reject. The third section deals with sadhana, or practice. How is it that one will realize whatever it is that the Vedanta is claiming should be realized, namely Brahman? The big question is, what is Brahman? And then the final section is the Muktipada, is dealing with liberation. How or what constitutes the actual goals of sadhana? How do you get there, and then what is it that you expect to get? That is essentially the idea. All right. So one thing we could do, and I'll try not to get bogged down in this, maybe I should first ask, what is our time frame, so I don't go on and on.
It's
1 hour and a half.
Okay, that's good. So I don't need to rush. Again, let me remind you, if there's something you want me to clarify, please stop me. I thought it might be interesting just to briefly look at least one or two, let's see how far we go, of the very beginning sutras of the Vedanta Sutra. We have some chalk here. The first one is Atato Brahma Jignasa. Now, I'll do this in transcription. Jigyasa, maybe that's long. The very first statement is just telling what is going to be the topic of these texts, the Brahma Sutras. It is in contrast with the Mimamsa, or Purva Mimamsa, which, if I remember, the sutra begins, Atato Dharma Jignasa, now it is time to inquire Jignasa about Dharma. So the Brahma Sutra itself can be seen as a commentary, a response, a reaction, even a rejection in some sense, but that's part of the debate, is it a rejection or not, of the Dharma Sutras. The claim of some is that it is a rejection. I think Shankara says it's a rejection. The claim of others is no, it is saying, first do that, look into the Dharma, understand what is the proper way of Dharma, of religious practice. And when you finish that, then you're not finished. Then it's time to go on to understand what is Brahma. Brahma, this term, again, how many are familiar? Let's just get some idea. Okay, so most of you. Brahman might be translated as ultimate truth, but then again, might not. It can be translated in many ways, sometimes more literally as the great, from the verbal root bri, that which increases, or the process of increasing. In any case, it's making a statement. What is going to be our topic? What is going to be our concern? What I want to say here is that the first verse of the Bhagavata Purana is going to begin with the second verse of the Brahma Sutras. I should write that down. Okay. Oh, I see. Okay. I don't think we'll run out. The second one says, Janma, birth, etc., meaning creation, maintenance, and renovation or destruction of it, of the universe, yataha, from that or from which, from, or, and here the Bhagavata tradition will say it's not a what, it's a who. It's from whom. That from whom the universe, the creation is coming, is going to be discussed. It's giving a definition, really. What is that Brahman? And the Bhagavata Purana is going to insist again and again that this Brahman is not nirguna, but it is saguna, it is with form. And the claim will be that this statement, janmad yasya yataha, is implying, if not saying directly, that this Brahman has form. This will be very significant. We may say, so what? But it becomes more significant as one reads the Bhagavata Purana. The entire verse, of the very first verse of Bhagavata Purana is, Janmadyasya yatonvaya vitaratas charteshu abhigyaswara tene brahma hridaya adhikavaye muhyanti yatsuraya tejo vari midamyata vinimayo yatra trisargo mrisha dhamna svena sada nirasta kuhakam satyam param dimahi. You got that, right? All of you Sanskritists? it's clear. The commentators to the Bhagavata Purana, and this was another point I wanted to make about significance of Bhagavata Purana. Unlike the others of these 18 major Puranas, the Bhagavata Purana has enjoyed extensive commentation. I believe today available there are at least 80 commentaries on either the whole or the part of the Bhagavata. So the commentarial tradition to the Bhagavata Purana is very extensive. And the commentators spend a lot of time on this very first verse that I just quoted. And essentially what they say is, everything is there in that one verse. If you can understand that one verse of four lines, you've got the whole thing. It doesn't mean, therefore, you don't have to read the rest of the book, but it will get you on the right track to understand the rest of the book. Okay, so, yes, this Janmadyasyataha is the second of the first five sutras, which are considered by the later tradition to be really the essence of what Vedanta is about. In fact, it becomes a tradition by Vaishnavas, at least. Instead of doing a commentary on the whole Brahma Sutras, they'll simply do a commentary on the first five and say, so you get the idea, you understand my position now that I've commented these first five, because it's you know, indicating how they're going to go with the rest of it. Well, the issue, as I said, with the second verse for the Bhagavata Purana is, what is the nature of this Brahman? The definition would usually be given, at least if you're following Shankara's commentary, is that this Brahman is nirguna. It is nirguna, meaning without qualities. It is qualityless. It is changeless. It is ultimately, in some sense, undefinable. It is something beyond all experience. And therefore, it can be seen, according to the Shankara tradition, as it is the ultimate reality, and therefore this experience of multiplicity, of attributes, of all that we know in this world, has to be seen as illusion. So his tradition is very much emphasizing illusionism or idealism of one form or another. Now, obviously we're going in a different direction here, and the next statement is, and by the way, this is called an adhikarana, a theme. The theme which is covered in the next sutra is that shastra or revelation is the source of knowledge of Brahman. So we get to epistemology here. How is it that one can know about Brahman? The next statement is shastra yonitvat. Okay, what's being said here? Well, First of all, we need to know that there is a purva paksha to this statement. Dead silence. You all know what a purva paksha is. Purva paksha means the preliminary philosophical position, which is to be defeated, which is to be overridden. I don't know English myself. Overridden by the siddhanta, the conclusion. So, what is the purva paksha here? Atmavare mantavya, according to, I believe, Brihad Aranyaka Upanishad, at least Gotama will claim that no, you can know the Absolute by inference, by reasoning, by inference, this ultimate truth can be known. The Brahma Sutra, this classic of the Vedanta, is saying, Shastra Yoni Vat, no, because the existence of Brahman is not to be inferred, because he, for the followers of the Bhagavad Gita, not it, is to be known through Shastra, through scripture. Shastra means revelation, that which is beyond inference, that which is beyond sense recognition, pratyaksha. So this is going to be, well, this is going to be something that the Bhagavata tradition will agree with the Shankara tradition. Yes, in order to know Brahman, you need Shastra, which in a way is justifying continuing on with the Brahma Sutras to explain the Upanishads, which are taken to be this revelation which is telling what is Brahman. Okay, so the text which is justifying or which is confirming this for the Bhagavata is again within this first verse. Tene Brahma Rida Ya. In this case, Brahma is taken to mean Brihat or great, and therefore scriptures, Shastra, are the great knowledge or knowledge of everything, and Hrida, which is meaning heart or by the heart, with the heart, refers, according to a later commentator, to Paramatman, to Brahman, yes, but not Brahman, Paramatman, the same ultimate truth which is within persons, within beings, within selves. So that knowledge is being given by someone who knows. What does that person know? He knows everything. So the general claim is you get the knowledge from the revelation of Shastra, but then someone may say, so how do we know that revelation is any good? The theistic answer is it's coming from someone who is a knower of everything. And of course, that will turn out to be not just Brahman, not just Paramatma, I say of course, but Bhagavan, or the ultimate person, Bhagavan, the possessor of Bhaga, of opulence. Okay, moving right along. Are we still, we haven't lost anyone yet? Okay. I admire you for your knowledge of English. My knowledge of Polish will probably come in my next life. Okay, the next, I'm just going to talk about two more adhikaras, and then I'm going to sort of turn around and take a different style or a different sort of explanation that the Bhagavata gives. I'm sort of clinging on to this first verse for now. The third verse I maybe won't write, or should I write? It's Tattu Samanvayat. It is the Samanvaya. It is the assertion that all of those texts called the Upanishads do have one point to make, and that is that there is Brahman and that they tell about Brahman. There is a cohesion. They are cohesive. They go together. They are saying one thing. So tattu samanvayat is a kind of a reassurance of that. And then in the Bhagavata Purana, again, this verse number one says, janmadyasya yatomvayat anvayat itaratas cha arteshu. By direct and indirect description of Brahman, Paramatma, Bhagavan, the Lord, one attains to artha, to the aim. What is the aim? The ultimate aim of actually not just mukti or liberation, but something beyond that, according to the Bhagavata. And then finally, there is a question about whether, it's kind of related to the third one about revelation, but the question comes, well, is Brahman knowable at all? Can it be known? Or is it something entirely beyond human capacity to know? Well, guess what? The answer is going to be yes. It is knowable. It is ikshater na ashabdat. Brahman is not inexpressible by words. Here is the more immediate issue. Where did I put that watch here? Let's see. Oh, yes. The immediate issue is whether Brahman can be communicated through words. because words certainly are dealing with limitations, limited tons. I don't need a glass. I'm fine this way. Indian style. okay. Why is it known? Why is it knowable? It comes to the same point in this first verse. Abhignya. Maybe I'll write that down. I keep throwing this chalk around. Can you see that? Abhignya. This truth, this Brahman, is omniscient, is all-knowing. And the argument will be that since this all-knowing Brahman is such, it or he has a capacity to communicate with words which he created. I knew you were going to do that. I'm sorry because I can do it without. Thank you. I guess this is the more civilized way here in the West. Thank you. All right. So this gives a little taste of what's happening in the Bhagavata Purana in terms of sort of philosophical disputation or argument. But the Bhagavata is going far beyond that. And now I want to also go beyond the sort of standard understanding of what is Vedanta. We usually would say, if we're talking about the six prime or classical or orthodox philosophies of India, we will speak of Purva Mimamsa, we'll speak of Uttara Mimamsa, Vedanta, and then Sankhya and Yoga and Vaisheshika and Nyaya, right? But as I said before, Professor Akhujkar has pointed out that Vedanta originally had a broader sense. And I think one could argue that the Bhagavata Purana, in a sense, is taking that broader sense if we think of it as a commentary on Vedanta. Or, if you don't like that, we can say it's a commentary on Vedanta, it's also a commentary on Yoga, it's also a commentary on Samkhya, and if one were to dig enough, probably one would find that it's a commentary on all the other. Well, yes, Purva Mimamsa by Sheshika, yeah, it's all there to one extent or another. I just want to say a little something about Sankhya and Yoga. And the commentary to both of these comes in the third book, where Kapila, who is understood to be Bhagavan, to be an avatar of Bhagavan, who is Paramatma, who is Brahman, is teaching. And who is he teaching? He's teaching his mother, Devahuti. Devahuti wants to know how to become liberated, how to reach this perfection which Vedanta is concerned about. And the answer comes in several chapters of explanation about, first of all, Sankhya, in the sense of what is this creation about, taking the categories of Sankhya, and then Yoga. Now that we know how the world is, what do we do about this fact? How do we become free from the world? Sankhya, as you may know, says there are two essential categories, Prakriti and Purusha. Boom. Prakriti. Is this a long A? I forget.
No.
Short. Okay. Prakriti and Purusha. There are two fundamental categories. Somehow or other, they come together, and that's the problem. And the perfection of both yoga and Sankhya is to separate these two. The Bhagavata Purana is saying, yes, there are these two fundamental categories, and there is one fundamental category, namely Brahman. Vedanta is saying there is one fundamental category from which everything comes. Janmadyasya yataha. Everything comes from this one fundamental category. So then, okay, how does that work? How does that go together? Is there one or are there two? So it's a kind of a both and argument that's being made. And the argument is hinging on the necessity for practice. In other words, it is not that one will understand simply by reading, discussing, thinking. One has to also act. And this is really what the sort of thread, the red thread through the Bhagavata Purana is, that there is a process of action. It is not what the Vedantic practitioners would understand as the practice of jnana, of practice. It is the practice of bhakti, of devotion. And devotion means devotion to someone. And in this case, it's devotion to Brahman, who is Paramatma, who is Bhagavan, who is, and then it will give names, Vishnu, Narayana, and especially Krishna. Now, to give you a little sense of what happens here, I'm just thinking if I could. Sometimes my back starts complaining when I'm standing up a lot. That's all right. To give a little sense what Kapila does, I have a couple of verses, three, four, five verses. Well, let's see. I better watch the clock. He's telling his mother how to practice yoga, but to do it in a, yes, theistic Bhagavata way. And at first he goes through a kind of a basic summary of Ashtanga Yoga as you would get it in Patanjali Yoga Sutras. And then he wants to concentrate. Unlike Patanjali, who will say, there are lots of things you can concentrate on. Of course, Ishvara Pranidhan, it's a nice thing. It'll help you if you concentrate on Ishvara, but you could concentrate on so many things, and they'll bring you different results. Kapila is going to say, concentrate on Bhagavan, and here's how to do it. And then he gives like a recipe. The devotee, the bhakta, should first concentrate his mind on the Lord's feet. Okay, so we're talking about someone who has feet, which are adorned, which are ornamented with the marks of the vajra. What is vajra?
Thunderbolt.
Yes, thunderbolt, a goad, an ankusha. This is something you control elephants with. A flag, a banner, and a lotus. Okay, so he's holding, not in two hands, but in four hands, these various ornaments or weapons. The splendor of there, the 2 feet, beautiful ruby nails, the nails of the feet, the toenails, resembles the circle of the moon and dispels the thick gloom of one's heart. So in other words, it's giving this very colorful, poetic description, in this case of the the nails of the feet of Vishnu as being like orbs of the moon, but colored like ruby. And it's giving a result, just as Patanjali would give in the Yoga Sutras, results for the various meditations that he suggests. But what sort of a result is he suggesting here? Not the sort you might expect from Patanjali. He says it will get rid of the thick darkness, the gloom, which is there in your heart, in the center of your consciousness, citta. And then he goes on, and this gets quite descriptive, the blessed Lord Shiva becomes even more blessed by bearing on his head the holy waters of the Ganga, which has as its source the water that washes the Lord's feet. These feet act like thunderbolts, like lightning, thrown to break, to shatter, to smash the mountain of sin, of papa, of wrong, which is stored in the mind of the meditating devotee. So here again, a result is given, and there's all sorts of, you might say, mythological, legendary imagery. There's Shiva, there's the Ganga coming from the feet. All of these associations are given to invite the person doing the meditation to make those associations, and then eventually to get this expected, or this anticipated, or promised result. Well, it goes on like that. First, a meditation on the feet, and then it goes up through the whole body. You know, the feet, the lower legs, the knees, the thighs, the chest, the stomach, the chest, the neck, the face, and then finally, and I'll read a little section from that. The yogi then meditates upon the beautiful face of the Lord, which is ornamented with curly hair, decorated with lotus-like eyes, and dancing eyebrows. Dancing eyebrows. A lotus surrounded by swarming bees, buzzing bees, and a pair of swimming fish would be put to shame by its elegance, by its beauty. So there's a description of a beautiful face, dancing eyebrows, and all of this is meant to attract. The idea here is that the yogi should be attracted to this object of meditation. It should not be a forced meditation. It should be a natural inclination to focus the attention. And then finally, with devotion, with bhakti, which is imbued with affection, the yogi should meditate within the core of his heart upon the laughter of the Lord, of Lord Vishnu. And then it describes that laughter. That laughter is so captivating, it's so attractive, that it's easy to meditate on. When Vishnu is laughing, one can see his small teeth, which resemble flower buds, jasmine. You have jasmine, yes. Which have become rosy by the splendor of his lips. So there's some reflection from his red lips onto his teeth. They've become reddened by that. Once devoting his mind to this, the yogi should no longer desire to see anything else. So what is yoga about? It's about some sort of control of the mind. Yoga citta vritti nirodha. The second Yoga Sutra says it's about some sort of constraint of the fluctuations, the vritti of the citta, of the mind. So the argument in the Bhagavata Purana is, here's how that's going to be successful, by selecting this object of meditation, which turns out not to be an object, but a person. Because this person is so attractive, therefore, it'll be natural. It'll be very easy to accomplish. Okay, before I go on, any questions about any of that? Or anything to clarify? No? We're still here? Okay. Now I want to jump. I mentioned that one of the questions in Vedanta is, is it possible to communicate with words the nature of Brahma? And the Bhagavata Purana sort of suggests an answer to this in its very first verse. It elaborates on this throughout the text. And then it devotes an entire chapter to this question in the 10th book. Book 10, chapter 87 is a series, well, it starts with a discussion. It's a question which then leads to a reference to another discussion, which leads to reference to another discussion. There's this layering of conversations. You find again and again in Sanskrit literature, especially Puranas. And finally, it comes to a discussion which takes place where the Shruti Gana, the Shruti themselves, is there something for me to clarify? Let's see here. Okay. The Shruti themselves, the Upanishads, become personified, and they one after another, offer prayers to Bhagavan. And in the substance of their prayers is basically, yes, it's very possible for you, Bhagavan, to make it possible for us, the Shrutis, to communicate what you are, what is Brahman. And oh, by the way, we, right now, by doing this praying, are communicating your nature. We are, just by this act of praying to you, communicating the nature of you. Okay? Did that make any sense? We're getting there. Okay, here we go with the first of the Shruti's prayers. And I like the Sanskrit. I wanted to recite that for you. I haven't memorized it, but it's very poetic. Alliterative. Jaya 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 jahya jamma jitta dosha gribhita gunam tamasi yat atmana samavarudha samastavada aga jagada kosham akila shaktya vabodhate Kvachit ajayatmana charato nucharin nigamaha. You got that too. Actually, these prayers are considered some of the most difficult to translate Sanskrit in the Puranic literature. And this is one of the reasons why people write commentaries, because they know we're not going to understand it. I'll read a translation, and then I want to read also some commentary done by an 18th century commentator. Okay, here we are. The Shrutis, these Upanishads, they pray to Bhagavan, to Vishnu, "Victory, victory to you, O unconquerable one. By your very nature, you are perfectly full in all opulences, Bhaga. Therefore, please, defeat the eternal power of illusion, Maya, who assumes control over the modes, guna, of nature, guna, to create difficulties for conditioned beings, for souls, bound souls in this world. O you who awaken all the energies of the moving and non-moving embodied beings, sometimes the Vedas, kvachit, can recognize you as you sport, lila, with your material and spiritual energies or potencies." Well, if nothing else, what you can get from that is that's there's a lot of philosophical content in the form of a prayer. And that's why, if nothing else, we can say this is a philosophical book. It is arguing something. It is making claims. It is not simply eulogizing. Okay, now to kind of get more out of that, I thought it may help if we look at the commentary of Vishwanath Chakravarti from the 18th century. He's a fun commentator because he imagines conversations which are not there in the original text to sort of unpack what is there. And in this way, he makes it more understandable. So, first of all, he takes the words jaya jaya in the beginning, which normally means victory. He says, this means, please reveal your super excellence. Okay. And then one can say that it's repeated out of a feeling of joy or reverence. All right. Vishnu might hear this prayer and respond to those who are praying, the Shrutis, how should I reveal my excellence? You're asking me to reveal. How should I do that? And the answer is, well, they answer requesting him to be merciful to destroy their ignorance, or to destroy the ignorance of all living beings, and to attract them to his feet, which this is a sort of a bhakti way of saying to his service, to his bhakti, to the practice of bhakti. And then the Lord objects. Again, this is in a kind of philosophical mode now of claim and counterclaim and argument and doubt. Then Vishnu says, but Maya, this illusory energy, who does impose ignorance on the jivas, is full of good qualities. Gribhita gunam. Why should I oppose her? She's doing a good job keeping us, the bound souls, in bondage. She's doing a great job. Leave her alone. Well, yes, the Upanishads answer, but she has taken on the three gunas of materia, the modes of nature, to bewilder conditioned beings and to make them falsely identify with their material temporal bodies. There's a problem there. In other words, this is not nice that you or that Maya is putting everyone into this illusion. Why? Because of suffering, which is, you could say, the core question in all of Indian philosophy: how to become free from suffering permanently. Her modes of goodness, passion, and ignorance are dosha grubita. They are tainted because you are not manifest in their presence, you meaning Vishnu. So, okay, it's all very well, you've, you know, made this grand illusion for all of us, but the problem is that you, Vishnu, are not also present there. If you would be present, well, maybe it wouldn't be so bad. But it's a terrible situation. And the Shrutis continue to say, besides, you are ajita. Ajita, Sanskritists? Conquered. Ajita, not conquered. You are ajita, which implies that only you, Vishnu, cannot be conquered by Maya, whereas others, like Brahma, and of course the rest of us, are defeated by their own faults, dosha. Well, then Vishnu, he says, but what proof do you have that she, Maya, cannot conquer me? How do you know that she can't conquer me? You're claiming this, but how do you know? And then they reply, the proof of this lies in the fact that in your original state, your original position, you have already realized the perfection of all opulences. Samavarudha samastabhaga, which is in the verse. Okay, so here's, and this was just one of so many verses. The point, what's the point? Again, it goes back to that original idea that this being, Vishnu, is taken to be all-knowing. In his original position, he knows his own powers, and therefore he will be able to communicate his identity to bound beings such as ourselves. Okay, now I just briefly want to mention a lila, a pastime of Krishna, which in a sense illustrates this. And this comes from the 10th book of the Bhagavata Purana, which, as I mentioned, is focused on the story of Krishna, his life beginning from birth or apparent birth up to not quite including, that's in the 11th book, but more or less his entire life. It's like a biography. And the first, I think, 40 chapters out of 90 are focused on his childhood. And it is this childhood lila which becomes the favorite object of remembrance by bhaktas of Krishna. Alright, so in this, in one of the chapters, there is description of how Krishna is playing as a small child with his friends. And as often happens in amongst young boys, they are making mischief with each other, and sometimes they want to, maybe they have an argument and one of them wants to get the other one in trouble. So the claim is made by Krishna's brother, who knows his brother, other than those who know, Balarama. And the claim is made to Yashoda, who is the mother or foster mother of Krishna. Krishna has eaten dirt. Well, mothers don't like it when their children eat dirt. As far as I know, they generally don't like it when the children eat dirt. And so she becomes concerned, and she wants evidence. She wants to pratyaksha. She wants to have a direct experience of what claim has been made, shabda, from Balaram, that Krishna has eaten dirt. So she goes to Krishna and she first discusses with him, I understand that you have eaten dirt, and of course Krishna denies it. because he doesn't want to be in trouble. And besides, it's not exactly true. Balaram is maybe simplifying the truth, and Yashoda is not going to understand it properly just by Balaram's description. So Krishna says, if you want to see, then I can show you that I have not eaten dirt. You can look at my mouth and you will see that I have not eaten dirt. And so Yashoda says, all right, then open your mouth. I want to see. So he opens his mouth. And when he opens his mouth, what does he see? What does she see? She sees dirt. But she sees a lot more than dirt. She sees the whole earth planet. And then she sees the whole cosmos. And then she sees herself looking into the mouth of Krishna, in whose mouth she sees, in other words, it becomes this kind of endless regress of creation coming within the mouth of this little boy. So the point of all this, well, it can be taken in many directions, but a simple point is that this person Krishna is identified in the Bhagavata as certainly the source of this creation, janmadyasya yataha, for whom, without any effort, not only is he the source, but he's the source without any effort, which would be a qualification for Brahman. Brahman cannot, by sort of the ground rules of Vedanta, be expected to exert itself in order to create. No. This Brahman, who is Paramatma, who is Bhagavan, effortlessly is creating, not only creating, but including within itself, or rather himself, this Brahman. Well, it goes on, the description goes on like that. Yashoda is naturally amazed. And this amazement is a whole other dimension of the Bhagavata, which we don't have time to talk about, and that is the development of devotional emotion, or bhava, which then brings it into the aesthetics of emotion, namely rasa. And that makes the Bhagavata a commentary to a whole nother genre of literature, rasa, literature dealing with kavya and rasa theory. But Yashoda is amazed, abhuta, she experiences abhuta bhava, and then Krishna decides, oh, this is not good. If Yashoda is amazed at me, then she's going to forget that she's my mother. And if she forgets that she's my mother, then she's not going to relate to me properly as a mother, and I can't no longer relate to her as a son. So it won't be any fun anymore. And since it won't be any fun, it's better I stop this whole thing right now. So he closes his mouth, and Yashoda basically forgets everything. How does she forget? That is explained by maya, by illusion. But what kind of illusion? Yoga maya, by a form of illusion which connects, yoga, which brings together, yukta, which has a fulfillment of higher purpose. And so, in this way, the lila, the past, what is sometimes translated as sport or pastime, the sort of free activity of this divine, this ultimate truth, which is not simply a divine being, but ultimate truth, satyam param, is closed for the moment, and then it moves immediately into another lila. It is the 10th book especially is a kind of series, one activity, one lila after another, each one demonstrating, so to say, different points or arguing different points about the nature of this supreme truth, which is Brahman, which is not only Brahman, but Paramatma and Bhagavan. Right. I must say I'm proud of myself. I got through my notes. Whether or not any of this made sense is something else. But I'll stop there and see if you have any comment or question or something additional that you want to add. Maybe those of you expert in the Bhagavata Purana may feel that I missed something that I shouldn't have missed. Anything. And if it's hard to say something in English, say it in Polish and we'll get someone to translate. How's that?
I would like to say that we were very much interested in what you said.
Thank
and
you.
If I could ask you
yes.
to explain the word and the idea of Maya, because I think it is not so clear
yeah.
to the Western people.
Okay, well, the word, I better write it out. what's sometimes called folk etymology will say that the word literally means not this or not that, that which is not, implying the more general understanding of Maya as illusion. But the term in the Bhagavata tradition can also mean mercy or grace, so divine grace, that which is descending from the from the ultimate, from the divinity, is grace. And this also then is understood as, well, I just mentioned yoga maya, as magic. Sometimes the word magic is used as a translation. It's a technical term used very much in Vedanta to explain, well, to explain what is the problem of our present existence. Maybe we can just say like that. As I hinted very briefly, the starting point, I think arguably for orthodox Indian philosophy is the problem of suffering. And of course that brings it in connection with the starting point for Buddhist philosophy, the four so-called noble truths of Buddhism. First of all, dukkha, there is suffering. And then the question, why is there suffering? And then the process, how to become free of suffering. And then the result, nirvana. In the classical, what later becomes known as Hindu philosophy, the same question is there, but with different explanations and different process and different answer, with a lot of overlap, one has to say. The philosophical explanation of to the answer, why is it that we are in a state of a condition of suffering, in one word, would be Maya. There is Maya. There is this this something which may or may not be real. And that becomes a huge issue in Vedanta. Is Maya real? Or is it not real? Or is it both real and not real? Or neither real and nor not real? And if it's real, where does it come from? The criticism that comes from the theistic Vedantists to the, let's say, non-theistic, generally the Advaitic theist position, is that they cannot explain what is this Maya and where it comes from. Since for them, there is really only Brahman as the one real. If Maya is coming from this one real, then it would seem to be compromised. And that becomes then the source of commentary upon commentary upon commentary to explain what is, how is it we got into illusion, or how is it we are in illusion. The idea being, if we can figure that out, then we can get out of it. We can become free from it. Yeah. That's, is that enough for a start?
Would be a subject of the second lecture.
Yeah, that's a whole second lecture. The Bhagavata elaborates extensively on it, and it uses this term Maya, as well as Yoga Maya, and, well, if I remember correctly, also Mahamaya, in the sense of making a distinction, a kind of one is negative and the other is positive, let's say like that. That Maya, which is giving us trouble, is Mahamaya. And that which is liberating, that which leads to perfection, is yoga. Yoga. Something? Yes?
You mentioned in the lecture, as I understood, that Bhagavata was written by a group of writers called Bhagavatas. Hmm. But we know from the tradition, or from the same Bhagavata, that it was written by Vyasa. Hmm. So how we can reconcile this two facts?
Well, from the perspective of modern scholarship, the understanding would be, probably, that it is attributed to someone, to Vyasa. That, and you see that in modern times. For example, if you take pre-modern, North Indian Hindi poetry, let's say, of Mirabai. So there's a collection of, I don't know how many, hundreds of poems attributed to Mirabai. But no one practically, except maybe people who are sort of simple, pious people, will believe that they were all written by Mirabai. Many of them, yes, but many more were written by somebody, and then they signed Mirabai because, hey, if it's seen as being written by Mirabai, then people will take it seriously. They'll publish it. They'll, you know, they'll honor it. So, okay, that could be taken in a negative sense that, you know, here they are, I don't know what that would be called, not plagiarism, but maybe some kind of reverse of plagiarism, giving credit, you know, to the other person, not to myself. It could also be taken as a kind of tradition of authorial humility, that, you know, who am I? I don't deserve any credit, and so on. So, Vyasa, he has, along with that, could be the understanding that, indeed, it is Vyasa who is writing through me. I have been inspired. And so, where is that inspiration coming from? It must be from Vyasa. How could it be from anyone else? Another option is that Vyasa, in fact, within the tradition, is known as a kind of, more as a title, really, more a position than a particular person. Different Vyasas at different times. So, in fact, one of the later commentators, 19th century commentators, he suggests, he doesn't insist, but he suggests that, because he wants to respond to, it's interesting, 19th century, he wants to respond to modern historical critical method, claiming Bhagavata is from 10th century, and he says, well, maybe it's from the 10th century, or maybe 9th century. He argues for 100 years earlier, and he says, and so maybe it was a Vyasa of that time, 9th century, common era, CE. So, okay, these could be ways of reconciling. If one wants to be literalist, then there's a problem. If one wants to say, no, here was a Vyasa of 5,000 years ago, and the book says that he wrote it, so we have to accept that that's what happened, period. The modern scholar will say, well, fine, but we need something we need some external proof. We cannot simply take the internal the statements from within the text. That is not enough to convince us. If you can convince us that there was someone who lived 5,000 years ago who wrote this by external evidence, then fine. But we don't have that till now. I mean, maybe, you know, archaeology is, digs are going on and they keep discovering things, you know, further and further down. They may discover some inscription that can be dated that says, you know, I, Vyasa, wrote the Bhagavata Purana. I don't know. Yes. Let's see, do we have any more time? Well, that's about the time. Maybe just one more little point I can make. It's
there is a question.
Oh, there is a question. I'm picking up. Okay.
W nawiązaniu do pytania poprzedniego. Bhagavatas wspomniał, że Bhagavatowie tworzyli pewnego rodzaju inkluzywizm w swoim podejściu do przy tworzeniu czy przy redagowaniu tekstu. Jak mam w takim razie podejść do całego tekstu? Traktować go literalnie, alegorycznie, symbolicznie. Opowieści o jodze, o sposobie medytacji, rozrywki z dzieciństwa.
Sounds like a question for a whole other lecture.
Czy ktoś się podejmie to przetłumaczyć?
Jeżeli pan pozwoli mi to powtórzyć, bo ja mu się wyłączyłam.
Summarize your question. I think I got some sense of it.
Pisali to w nastawieniu takim inkluzywistycznym.
So the Bhagavatas, they were writing
yes.
And
jak teraz mamy podejść do tekstu?
So how we are supposed to
do it.
Approach it.
Yes,
approach it. How to read it?
Literally.
Literally, yeah. Allegorically, yeah. Anagogically, yeah. Topologically. Well, the tradition of commentators, I mentioned there are some 80 commentators, and by no means have I read them all. I've read bits of some. But they don't seem to hold strictly to a literal understanding, nor do they seem to have a problem with a literal understanding of the text. They seem to take the position that if indeed this Brahman is all powerful, then everything is possible for it. That seems to be their basic understanding. They're not going to say, you know, obviously Krishna did not actually show Yashoda the world in his mouth. They never say that. So traditional commentators and readers, they didn't have a problem. I think my understanding is this: they could see things literally and figuratively almost simultaneously without a problem. They could read both simultaneously. I think as moderns we have a very crippled, impoverished power of reading, which, and I think it's in some sense become more impoverished by our advances in 19th and 20th century historical critical reading. We can no longer just read it and kind of take it as it is without saying, wait a minute, that couldn't have happened. You know, we are doing the hermeneutics of suspicion from the very first step. You know, we can't sort of just be open to what the text wants to give, which is a kind of richness, I think, which it's hard for us to recover. But yeah, I would say inclusivist in that sense also. Inclusivist in terms of there are more than one divinity that can be venerated as this Brahman, and there are more than one way that this text can be understood. It's not only this way to be understood. And the justification for that is that it's poetry. I think we often forget that so much literature, classical Indian literature, is written in the form of poetry. Poetry means that you're using words in ways that are extending, you're stretching their meanings. You want the richness of the meaning to be there, not, you know, you have connotations as well as denotations. And it goes a step further in Indian literature, you also have suggestion. And it's all there, and it's all to be relevant.
May I ask another question?
Oh, okay, please.
Time,
yes.
Which concerns this open mouth of Krishna.
Okay.
Because it reminds the story told by Markandeya. And I wanted to ask if the family Bhargava, Rigo, plays any role in Bhagavata tradition story.
Bhrigu, he appears in the Bhagavata, and he has a very amusing sort of role. And that is that he has been sent by the devatas to find out which of the devatas is the ultimate. And so he goes first to Brahma, and then he goes to Shiva, and then he goes to Vishnu. And with each of them, he confronts them in a rather confrontational way, in a sort of nasty way. With Brahma, he simply thinks evil of him. And with Shiva, he says something unpleasant to him. And with Vishnu, he physically gives him a kick with his foot on his chest while Vishnu is lying down being massaged by Lakshmi. And because Brahma had reacted negatively, Shiva had reacted negatively to his negative confrontation, but Vishnu had not reacted negatively. He had simply, in fact, he apologized. He said, "My dear Bhrigu, I hope I didn't hurt your foot. I have a very hard chest, and I do hope that it didn't break your toes." So then Bhrigu was convinced, so he must be ultimate divinity because he is perfectly self-controlled. He does not become angry. So that's, I think he appears elsewhere. I can't immediately come to mind. I think not extensively beyond that. He's mentioned usually in lists of sages, but here he appears and does a kind of experiment, if you like, sort of, what would you call it, behaviorist psychology experiment on God. Okay. All right. Well, I hope I've given you something worthwhile to expand some understanding about this tradition. And thank you all very much for having me, for listening.
Thank you very much.
wkrótce ukaże się książka po polsku. On jest wydany.
Jest obiad, u mnie w domu. Aha. Ono się napięte.
Tak, 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 właśnie.